We're talking to Bob Drew, who is now 81 years old. Bob was in the Army Infantry during World War II and is going to tell us his experiences as a young soldier in Europe.
Okay, here I am, and I'm going to start my little tale of things that were unusual that I experienced in World War II, particularly in combat and after the battle was over on May 7th, 45. What happened, some things that came about for me that were, I felt, unusual. Anyway, the picture would be I'm an 18-year-old, drafted right out of high school, but I'll start leaving the USA on December 29th. Excuse me, 28th, I guess it was. We left Camp Kilmer, New Jersey. We're herded onto a ship called the Aquitania, which is a very luxurious British passenger cruiser ship, which had been converted for troops. So there's about half again as many bodies in that ship as there would be if it was on a luxury cruise earlier before the war. Anyway, my last recollection was going out of New York Harbor, and I've seen the Statue of Liberty with beautiful lights on it in peacetime. Because of the blackouts on the East Coast, there were no lights. We could tell where it was, we could see the silhouette of it, but that was the last we saw of the United States. And for some of us, felt like it might be the last time we'd ever see the land we were born on. Anyway, trip took about 7 days and 8 nights to get to Britain. We were chased at one point, the whole convoy, by two German submarines, which turned out to either never fire anything or just chased us to scare us. We got alerted and put on life jackets. That was about a day and a half out of Scotland, landed in Greenock, which the Scots pronounce Greenock, and disembarked. That took hours and hours, and found ourselves on train going down, troop trains going through southward through England, west of London, and we got strafed. That was the first experience we had hearing bullets. They were far away, and they were more of a nuisance thing. I think the Germans were trying to remind the English they were still on the offensive. Ship landed somewhere on the edge of Le Havre, France. We disembarked and went to what they call a replacement depot, which is a place that you are sorted out and assigned to different units. That started happening. New Year's came and went, and we're well into January before I finally was taken to Reims, France, with several other GIs I had gone over with. Someone asked, "What rank are you?" "You're a private until you're in a year, either stateside or in combat. Then you become a PFC unless you goof up." So I was not a private first class. We were nothing first class. We were replacements. Young and naive. Anyway, get you up to the front here. In Reims, we were sorted out and then taken to Luxembourg, right south of Luxembourg, and that was a final staging area. At that point, we could see and hear what was going on not too far away. It was a mile and a half. Artillery, planes coming in, dropping bombs. There was a lot of excitement. Went in 6x6 trucks. There's still quite a bit of snow on the ground, freezing cold at night. Daytime it would warm up and the snow would melt, go into the foxholes that we later were to occupy, and mud. Mud was almost worse than the frozen ground to contend with. Anyway, I was issued a rifle by the squad. Our squad leader, who was a sergeant, and I was informed that it didn't shoot straight. It had been the last bearer of it, apparently, was no longer, and it got thrown off when he was shot down, and a tank backed over it, It still worked, still fired, but I wasn't the best shot in the world, and I was told to correct so many degrees left if I wanted to hit a target. Fortunately, that only lasted a week, and I lasted more than a week. I could talk an hour on some of the gory details of the next few days, but I think it's better not to dwell on that. If you saw the film Band of Brothers, you get a pretty good idea of what it was like. And I was in the tail end of that, but enough that I'd never want to repeat what I saw and took part in. Very lucky, I came home with a bad left foot from freezing, but other than that, I came through that part of my life unscathed. I think the mental damage that it did to us was far worse than the physical. The prayers we uttered forth, my buddies and I, were that we not suffer long, that if we got hit, it'd be over with quickly, and we not go home maimed. It seemed like the fear of death wasn't as bad as the fear of being maimed and unable to carry on a normal life. Several people I knew came back like that. Some were repaired and came back before the war was over. Others were permanently disabled and sent back to states and discharged. Anyway, let us get out of that part of the country. That was in Belgium. We went from Luxembourg into the corner and went northeast of Bastogne. And any of you who've read much about the Battle of the Bulge know that Bastogne was a turning point, thanks to the 101st Airborne and a few other crack outfits. It was no picnic for anybody. Anyway, as time went on, we went through the forests of that were immediately east of the Belgian border in Germany, heading for a city called Aachen. And one of my memories is walking through the woods early in the morning. We had coffee made on a camp stove, and we'd thrown away our gas masks. We'd thrown away part of the Browning automatic rifle we had, the bipod. It was too heavy. And I was walking along thinking what a beautiful stroll in the forest this was going would be if we just weren't at war. When I were spread out, probably 50 yards between us in a straight line moving forward, when I stepped just close to a log, and suddenly a German uniform came up right at me. With the bearer of it had a Tommy gun, I think, or the burp gun that Germans used. And lo and behold, I was quicker than he was. Neither one shot anything. I just told him get his hands up. I did speak German, but I think he knew what I would have meant, even if I couldn't speak German. The thing that impressed me was here was a boy that was even younger than I. I'm 18. I had started to shave. I had a beard. This kid looked like he had peach fuzz. He probably was around 14. I think he told me, "Ich bin 15," barely 14. And he was ready to shoot us. He was grateful to be taken captive. And I had my first prisoner. From there on, it got warmer, the snow melted, it rained, it was nasty, horrible weather, but the bulge was pretty well over with. And there were pockets of Germans, particularly SS units, that were going to fight to the last straw and then kill themselves anyway. But if they could kill you along with it, they would. They were like trapped rattlesnakes. That started to clear out some, but there were pockets all through that area till we got to the Moselle River. At the Moselle River crossing, I remember seeing Patton long distance, George S. Patton in the reel. The day we saw him, we heard he'd lost his temper, and he started to wade the Moselle River upstream from where I was in his undershirt with fishing boots on to show the men that they should follow orders and not balk. There was a lot of balking going on. This was under fire, a four-star general taking a chance near bullets. That was kind of George's weak points. Anyway, we got across there without a pontoon bridge. We got to the Rhine River. A bridge had to be built. Before we got across the Rhine, we got to the city of Mainz, Mainz, which was one of the hiatus for the 90th Infantry Division. Incidentally, as you could tell, my division, which was happened to be the 90th Infantry with the tanks attached to it and the artillery, was under George S. Patton. It was a very proud day that when we joined and realized we were going to be working under Ike Eisenhower and G.S. Patton. I got us across the Rhine River, that there's a lot of tales in between. 3 nights before getting to the bridgehead to cross the Rhine, I was on advance guard duty in a foxhole with my foxhole buddy, and our foxholes were probably 40 yards apart, staggered, so they weren't all in a straight line. And there's still snow on the ground. And about 3 o'clock in the morning, we could hear the Krauts, as we call them, packing up their kitchen stuff and moving. We weren't sure if they're going to move towards us or away from us. We finally determined that they were moving away. However, we saw two men out in a field. It was quite foggy at that hour, and these two men would move in unison, back and forth, and coming towards us, but zigzagging. And we yelled something out there, and nobody did anything, so we took the Browning automatic rifle and shot them down. We figured, well, now then all hell will break loose. The rest of them will come after this one, these two. They were probably the scouts. In the morning, as it started to get daylight, we looked out and there was a dead Holstein cow. The front one-third of it was black, and the back tail quarters were black. So you had two legs black in front and two in the back with white in the middle. So there was no two men, it was a cow. And within an hour after the sun came up, half the village came out, butchered the cow, and took all the parts back into the village. And this was still with bullets flying around different places. Anyway, I don't tell that tale to everybody till years later. Our first sergeant had to laugh at it, but he told us we ought to be more on the ball than to do that. However, he's glad we shot in case it was somebody coming at us. That was a minor thing, but those things stick in your mind. At least they stuck in my mind. Also, I've talked to other infantry veterans that crossed the Rhine River all the way from Remagen down way south of where we crossed, and three of the ones I talked to in the past 50 years had a s experience similar to what I experienced, which is getting halfway across the bridge, and here comes a German Focke-Wulf with a wing bomb, two wing bombs, and strafed the troops, all of us along the bridge. There was a couple people wounded and one casualty, but they dropped the bomb, and the bomb landed probably 75 yards from where we were walking, and it didn't go off. It was a dud, or I probably wouldn't be sitting here talking about my experiences.
One of the things I'm really interested about is you found, I believe, some of the soldiers found film, or maybe commanders found film and asked you to get it developed.
Yes, it went something like that. This would be April. It's before thing stuck in my mind. Roosevelt's death was declared 3 days after I was assigned to develop film for our outfit. And we found a photo studio in Sulzbach-Rosenberg. That's somewhere between Frankfurt, Germany, and Wieden, which is near the Czech border. We're halfway across Germany from the Rhine River to the Czech border in this town. I wasn't in on taking the town. I was in on taking of the city of Mainz, but We followed along. The tanks went in, and it was declared that it was surrendered. So we went in this photo studio, myself and two other people. I learned how to develop film in the summer camp in New England way before that. Now all the materials were there labeled, and I can remember the home of Agfa Film, which is German film. Anyway, we developed as many films as the battalion commander wanted us, and there was a photographer assigned to the battalion, and he brought the film in, and we processed it. Wasn't the greatest job in the world, but it was good enough. Then we found a whole lot of film. This was all vacated. The apparently a Nazi high-ranking Nazi government official owned this thing. He cleared out and just left the place. There were rolls of film that had never been developed, 35 millimeter. And there was also pictures there and negatives. And we went ahead and were through our own work, developed some of this, thinking, well, maybe it wouldn't turn out, but some of them turned out quite well. And it showed some of the major Nazi leaders in that area. County, we'd call it here a county like Pennington County in South Dakota, but it was, they call it Regierungsbezirk. It's a government jurisdiction. There were pictures there of going all the way back to when Hitler was in designing the Nuremberg Stadium with Albert Speer and some other notable high-ranking Nazis, parading in the Nuremberg Stadium. Hundreds of thousands strong. There were a lot of pictures of family life in that area. It was pretty much a farming area, but there was an awful lot of pictures of taken not too long before we got there. And they were snatched up. They went to division headquarters and were used. I don't think ours were the only ones that were ever found and developed, but I thought it was a unique experience to be in a dark room developing German film that the people never even developed, and they cleared out and left. Notably, I should say, worthy of note, the next major thing that I can remember that was still sticks with me today is going into Flossenbürg concentration camp, which is somewhere near the Czech border, east of Weiden, Weiden, Germany. It was a smaller camp, but it was one of the oldest ones. In fact, it had been a mother camp. They farmed their excess people out to Dachau and Buchenwald and a few other of the notable camps. I definitely my company was not the first ones to walk into the place, but we were one of about 40 companies that went in, and managers of the place had cleared out. All the Nazis had left. The SS had left. They left displaced persons there in charge. They had nowhere to go. They were fed fairly decently, I guess. And we talked to them. I talked German to a Polish fellow that his German was about as bad as mine, but we did communicate. And he was a shoveler. He shoveled bodies all day into the incinerators. He'd been spared because he was part of the workforce. When you got too weak to work, then you became one of the next ones to be gassed and disposed of, incinerated. The odor that place had stayed with me to this day. I can still, if somebody brought that odor back, I could tell you right away it was decaying flesh. Also, when the war was over, I was assigned to a place called Würzburg on the Main River, and that'd been firebombed, and a lot of the rubble had hundreds and hundreds of bodies decaying under it. And that was the same odor that I remembered from Flossenbürg. We were there, my outfit was there 3 days, and we helped sort people out, the ones that were still living, got the medics to the people that needed it the worst. Another recollection I have has to do with smoking, which I certainly wish in some time later in my life I'd never started. And I can't blame U.S. government for that because my parents both smoked clear into their late 70s. And that is, we could give these prisoners cigarettes, which really wasn't too good if you were on limited oxygen and at death's door to smoke a cigarette, but definitely no food. We could give water and soft drinks maybe, but which we had canned lemonade made out of powder. And we wanted so much to give them something. And what a sensation to be there and you had something you could give them and you couldn't give them. And you couldn't explain in a language they didn't understand why you couldn't give it to them. Anyway, they hugged and they were so amazed that it finally was over and they were being freed that the look that day I certainly will never forget.
Why was it that you couldn't give them food?
I guess if you're at the point of malnutrition so badly, it'd be like drinking a gallon of water if you were thirst bound. You'd bloat and you could kill yourself. So if you put all that into a digestive system, because the hunger was there, I think they'd have eaten a fried rat if you'd had a you happen to have a cooked rat you could cut up and they'd eat it. But they had to get IVs. And some of the people we saw there died within 48 hours. They were gone. It was that close. They claimed this Polish guard that was the shoveler. He said there's about 100 people a day where the corpses would come to him. But out of that 100, maybe 10 had died that very day or the day before. It was an average of 10 people a day expiring. And of course, the total population was 16,000 people in that particular prison camp. Went back there with my wife some 40 years, 55 years later, and did not realize how many German soldiers were executed, were buried there themselves because they defected. They refused to follow orders. They would not operate the gas chamber. And so they were just taken out, lined up, and shot like anyone else. And so it was a big section of just German prisoners shot. They weren't prisoners when they went in there. They were guards supposed to be working there, following orders. I wanted to say one more thing about the SS troops who were going to die for the Führer, regardless of where, when, or how. It'd be a complete disgrace to be taken prisoner, very much like the Japanese in World War II, the kamikaze type of Jap who would die for the emperor but would not be taken prisoner. Not all the SS were that way, but if you ran into one that was like that, you could not fool around with them as a prisoner. They'd spit at you and kick you and do anything and ask to be shot. The worst disgrace was to be taken prisoner by any enemy. Well, that was quite something new to me. I couldn't picture people that were that devoted to any government regime or any emperor or dictator or leader that they would rather give their life than surrender to the enemy. The war ended for us, of course, May 7th, 45. On June 15th, 45, our outfit, the 90th Infantry Division, paraded for George S. Patton and General Zhukov of the Russian. I had the honor of being back maybe 150 yards from the two people. Zhukov had spoke English, somewhat broken English, and was thanking the Americans for helping save their hides. A very fine general, and I think Patton respected him. The only thing Patton didn't in his speech that he gave that day was he thought we had too much emphasis on the U.S. military on punishing German war criminals who needed, there was no doubt, they should be brought to justice and the trials should be held. But he thought we were ignoring the communists. We were ignoring what Stalin had planned for Germany. And, you know, as things unfolded and time went on, well, that was the big threat, the Iron Curtain and what followed after that. So that was a landmark for me to be that close to two very important generals.
How long did you stay in Europe after the war ended?
I was there for a year and a half, and I got out of guard duty and driving truck duty by the fact I spoke some German. So they needed anybody that was a little beyond saying just ja and nein. I had German in high school and had a grandfather that taught me. I never used it, but I sort of used it then, and I got quite proficient at it. When you use it every day and you're using it to earn your living, I'd study at night and had many more Germans spoke good English than Americans that spoke any German that could be intelligent.
Bob Drew, thank you very much for sharing your story with us. And we also thank you for your service to your country.